As you can see, the title of the message is A Week of Drama. And you may have noticed some drama in just the presentation that has been done before you. And that is by design to be able to see that. But what we recognize is that there are different opinions as to what constitutes drama, or what is good drama, or what kind of drama we like. And there are some people who are characterized by their drama. You have heard of someone who is referred to as a drama queen. And maybe you have some that you're related to, that you know. But that's a familiar designation. Some people are highly expressive and dramatic. Most people enjoy various dramatic presentations. It's part of our entertainment that we have available to us, and this sort of thing has been going on for a very long time. And there are different varieties, different genres, and they widely quite a significant amount. But I thought it might be helpful to consider a definition of drama. This one particularly focused on the literary area. It is a composition in verse or prose intended to portray life or character or to tell a story, usually involving conflicts and emotions through action and dialogue, and typically designed for theatrical performance. And we're familiar with the movies because the movie industry is pretty big and it's readily available in all kinds of places and ways these days. And it focuses on also the element of conflict and those areas of concern that are of a more serious tone or nature. And so that's kind of some of the idea. So maybe a general definition would include something like this: a state, situation, or series of events involving interesting or intense conflict of forces. And that fits the week that we are considering, as we are on the first day of the week that's known as Passion Week, where Christ is recognized as the coming king in his entry into Jerusalem. And so, taking this idea of drama, we need to put it in some sort of context. And you can think about lots of different areas and ways where you see drama, but this one, I think, is also helpful for us to think about. And we've just considered some of these elements and have gone through much of the details of Passion Week in our presentation this morning. And what we want to recognize is that this context is the most significant event of all of history. And so, therefore, the drama is more than just entertainment. It is far greater than that. And the major emphasis takes place over a specific week of time. And so I want to begin by just thinking back through this week to start with and look at the basic timing of the week. And I don't want to spend too much time here. You can look at any one of the available harmonies of the Gospels and try to put this together. But just to start off, Sunday was the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. That was the main emphasis and focus there. During the evenings, Jesus would go to Bethany, and that's where he would spend the evening, probably at the house of Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And then on Monday, this was the occasion where he was coming into Jerusalem and sees the fig tree that he curses. He cleanses the temple. And that's kind of the main emphasis there. And then on Tuesday is a bigger day with more activities. He finds the fig tree withered, and then from that he teaches on the matter of faith. There are those who come to him who question his authority, and then he responds to them and confounds the questioners. This is some of the background to what we have looked at relative to the Olivet Discourse that we've been dealing with in Matthew 24 and 25 in particular. And so he pronounces the woes. He laments over Jerusalem, and anticipates what's going to happen there, and particularly focuses in on the temple and the demise. And then the disciples ask the questions, well, when will these things be? And then he gives the Olivet Discourse. And so this is all on Tuesday. And then on this day also, we recognize that it was when Judas bargains to betray Jesus. And he's dealing with the Sanhedrin there. Then Wednesday is often referred to as the silent day. Don't really have any specific details referenced there. It's speculated that maybe he even stayed in Bethany that day, dealing with various preparations for the next day's events. So then Thursday, this involved the preparation for the Passover meal. Peter and John were sent to get the animal, the preparation of the lamb, the needed elements for the Passover meal. After sunset, they would have had the meal together with the disciples, and this would have been the regular Passover meal. Jesus washes his disciples. Judas departs, and then Jesus institutes the Lord's Supper. And it's interesting to notice that Judas departs before he proceeds with that. And so that was a significant time as well. And then we have the Upper Room Discourse, the end of John 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17 is kind of sometimes tacked on with that. That's the high priestly prayer of Christ. But the Upper Room Discourse is going to be focused on his disciples in preparation for the church, whereas the Olivet Discourse, as we had noted, is focused on the Jews, and it's their last message to the Jews and anticipates their coming into the limelight again in the future, but with an interceding time in between there. Then there's proceeding to, and this is getting later into the evening, they proceed to the Garden of Gethsemane, which is just to the east of the temple area in Jerusalem, where he is involved in the time of prayer. Then the betrayal of Judas coming there, the arrest associated with that, going to the house of the high priest as the Sanhedrin is convened, and then Peter denies Christ in that process. And so I'm going to put all the trials together, even though they started probably later in Thursday evening, but not knowing the exact time. So we're going to put them together. Goes before Annas, the father-in-law of Caiaphas, kind of functioning in a sort of an alongside position of probably like his cabinet, you know, like our government works, where you've got cabinet officials, advisors. Anyway, met at his place first, then before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, and then before the Sanhedrin, the elders and chief priests, and then before Pilate, and then before Herod, and then before Pilate again, after which he is scourged and mocked, and there's some of this going on in between as well. But just trying to put them in some sort of an order to kind of picture in our minds how things are coming together here. And then when all of this is transpiring and Judas sees what's going on, then he hangs himself. Christ is on the cross. The seven sayings on the cross take place there. And, of course, in between there, Jesus carries his cross with the help of Simon and so on prior to getting to the cross. And then the death of Christ, the veil is torn, his side is pierced, the rocks, the earthquake, and the lambs are slain in the temple at what is recognized as the exact time that the Messiah is killed, coinciding with that. So the timing is really quite significant. And then, of course, we recognize Joseph requests the body of Christ, and he's put in his tomb, and the guard is placed at the tomb, and so on. Then we have Saturday, which is the Sabbath, the day of rest, and then Sunday we'll deal with next week. So we'll save that. So just a quick overview to see the timing of the week. So what was going on there? Then we want to think about, well, the main places of the week. And Bethany, where Jesus spent his night. So if you want to just kind of glance up here, you see this is the Temple Mount area. This is the Mount of Olives, and we're going east over here. Bethphage and Bethany. So it's just going right across this direction here. A couple little valleys in between there, the Kidron Valley here and a little bit of a valley there. So just to give you a little bit of a picture, not very far, it's 2 miles basically from the Temple Mount area to Bethany. You can walk that in just a few minutes, maybe, but usually. I think 30 minutes you might be able to pull that off. So not too far. But he goes and spends a night, family home kind of environment there. And then, of course, the temple. This is the temple of Jesus' day. This is a model of Herod's temple at the Israel Museum. And give you an idea of the scale of size compared to some of the other things around there. This is the Fortress Antonio here, the Roman garrison right on the edge of the temple to keep an eye on things, because this is where everything was happening most of the time. That's why Jesus would go there and spend some of his days there teaching, because it was a gathering place, particularly around feast times, because that's where people would connect, and it was the place to be. And then, of course, we have the Mount of Olives. This is an angle kind of looking off from roughly from the area of the Temple Mount, looking off toward the east. And you can see some of the churches that have been built on this area in today's time frame. Again, just to give a little bit of a picture, this is where Jesus would go sometimes for some quiet time, of course, on the last evening. That's where he went to pray. There are olive groves around in this area that are still there to this day. Some of the trees are recognized as being very, very old and maybe not having survived that length of time, but because they grow up from the roots of others, they would have been related to the trees that would have been there in Jesus' time. Then there's a picture of the palace of Caiaphas. You get a little bit of a picture. This may or may not be the exact place where Peter's denials had taken place, but it would be somewhat comparable, if not the same. And then the Praetorium, if you can make out, there's a little bit of an arrow here pointing to the Fortress of Antonio. And so some of the trial areas would have been probably in this area here, right near the temple area. Just to give a picture of some of the places, because we're talking about a drama unfolding in a particular place and time with real people. And so the next thing I want to think about is the people. And I want us to think about some unexpected faces. Now, when I show you who I'm going to talk about, you say, "Well, I know that. That's all familiar." But you might want to think about it in terms of, well, is that somebody that you would have expected to have ended up being notorious, notarized, recognized regarding what they are now known for? Would you have expected that? And so this is the human drama. And think about the dramatic effect, the conflict, the emotion that's part of the equation. So first of all, the response of Judas. Judas has been described prior to the things that we know about him after the fact and that the gospel writers recognized. Prior to that, he probably would have been recognized as a perfect disciple. He was trusted. He was given the money bag. He was the good guy. I mean, you got some other characters who are kind of off the wall at times, but Judas was, you know, he was like the straight and narrow. He was the accountant. He had it all together. So they thought. And then it says, then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, what are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you? And they counted out 30 pieces of silver. And you think about, how did Jesus miss that when he was selecting his disciples? You know, wouldn't you think he would have, like, done a background check and, you know, researched things out a little bit? And then you think about, well, we deal with people all the time, and sometimes they're receptive to the gospel, and sometimes they're not. And here's somebody who was with Jesus for 3.5 years, and he goes AWOL, and he goes against him. And you'd think, he was with us. How could that be? And what was wrong with Jesus? Wasn't he living the Christ-like life? I mean, you think about, that's kind of an interesting, what happened there? I mean, Judas appears to have been an opportunist. He was probably captivated by what he thought might be happening, like many of the other Jews did, thinking that there's going to be a political revolt here. And we're going to finally overthrow Rome like the Zealots and so on. And then he finally realizes, boy, things aren't going so well. This whole Jesus Messiah thing is really tanking, and I'm going to get on the good side of history here. I'm going to go with the people who've got the money and who've got the power, and that's what he does. So interesting to think about. And then, of course, the unseen antagonist. I mean, any kind of literature, any drama is going to have your antagonist and your protagonist. And who is this? The behind-the-scenes antagonist. You have to recognize this. The text certainly does. Now, after the piece of bread, Satan entered him, that is Judas, from that context. Then Jesus said to him, what you do, do quickly. And so it's simply an acknowledgement that behind what Judas was doing and what was driving him was a satanic influence. The exact nature of that, we don't really know for sure, whether he was possessed or simply influenced. Because then we have to come to Peter, and Peter, after he gives his strong response, of the recognition of the deity of Christ, essentially, then when Jesus says, you know, I'm going to have to be killed and suffer and all of this, and Peter said, no way, Lord. And so Jesus turned to him and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. Well, I don't know if you're thinking like I'm thinking, but if Jesus had said that to me, I would have been offended. What are you talking about? Me? Satan? How can you even put me and him in the same breath? What an identification. Was Satan actually behind him, or was he identifying with Satan's kind of thinking? Or was there some genuine influence there? Don't know if we can say that with absolute certainty. But he certainly recognizes that it was a satanic kind of response, at the very least. You're an offense to me, for you're not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. You're just thinking about what you want for you. That is, you want me to stick around. But you don't realize the bigger picture of what has to happen here. And I think we also come to the realization that Satan didn't know exactly either, because if he had known that when the Messiah actually died on the cross, that he was done, his power was over, he was judged, he wouldn't have done it. But it was too late. Well, then we have the responses of Peter. Several of these passages were recognized. I'm going to go through this somewhat quickly. But we remember that when Jesus said, "Who do you say that I am?" Peter said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And he was acknowledging, you know, this was Peter. He had some insight. He was tracking with Christ. He wasn't like Judas, who, you know, really wasn't all there with him. He sounds like he's all there. And then Matthew 16, 21 to 22, this is what I had just previously referenced. Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things, and be killed and raised the third day. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Now, here's another spot where you kind of want to think, what was Peter thinking? Did he not just acknowledge just previously, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God"? Now he's going to rebuke him and say, "No, Jesus, don't talk that way. Who do you think you are?" Again, a little bit of drama there. Of course, Peter is definitely the drama guy, without any question. And then, of course, he's the one who's going to deny him three times, Jesus says. And, of course, we know that that does, in fact, happen. And, of course, this passage had been read to us previously. But you'll notice how Peter vacillates. One minute he's saying, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And the next minute he's saying, "I don't know him." Fortunately, we are so much more informed than Peter that we would never do that, right? We would never, one minute, come across communicating that we are 100% tracking with Christ, and the next minute we say or do something so opposite. You wonder, how did that come out of the same person's thinking? But there it is. And he went out and wept bitterly. There's some drama for us to think about. And you just have to wonder, what did he really feel like after that? The inclusion of Simon. They found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. They compelled him to bear his cross. And I've thought about this passage as well. What if it had been you? I mean, why is this even in the text? It's such an interesting thing. There's this little verse that's tucked in there. And they grab this guy and they throw him in and say, "Hey, you carry the cross." That to me kind of suggests the idea of any one of us should have been carrying the cross that Christ carried because we deserved it. And that's a good picture. Just put yourself in there. And they found a person of Albuquerque and plug your name in there because we should have been carrying the cross when it comes right down to it. Well, then there's the inclusion of Herod and Pilate. I mean, these guys didn't want anything to do with the issues that the Jews fought over. And, you know, your religious issues. They didn't want anything to do with that. And the interesting thing is that they were enemies of each other, as the text tells us here. For previously, they had been at enmity with each other. But that very day, Pilate and Herod became friends with each other because they sort of had a common enemy. Whether you want to think about the common enemy being Christ or the Jews who were against Christ, either way, they kind of got together. And again, that's another dramatic element. It's part of the whole story that just it makes it so real. Those details. Somebody didn't just make this stuff up. This is real. The inclusion of the thief, and we've read through this, but the acknowledgement of the two responses of the criminals, the one who says, "If you're the Christ, save us," the other says, "Don't you realize we're in the same or worse condition than he is?" And then he acknowledges, "This man has done nothing wrong. But we're getting what we deserve. And again, I would say, well, put yourself in that place. I mean, isn't it interesting? We've got these two people that are hanging on the cross. Why are they there? Why is this part of the equation? Why did God, when he put this all together, put two other people there, one rejecting, one accepting? I mean, that's where we can plug ourselves into the equation and say, that should have been me. I should have been on the cross instead of him. And what would my response have been? Blasphemed? Or recognition? He hasn't done anything wrong. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. What's that an acknowledgement of? It's an acknowledgement that he is the Messiah. It's a clear, positive response. And Jesus said, today you'll be with me in paradise. And he didn't have a whole lot of time to get his act together, you know, to straighten up his life. Just trust Christ. And that's the encouragement for us as well. And then we have the inclusion of the centurion. And again, I can't help but think about, here's this hardened soldier who's probably seen dozens, if not more, of these crucifixions. And, you know, it's like you've seen one, you've seen them all, you know, somebody dies, you know, what's the big deal? And he's, not this time. And he sees it, and he said, truly, this was the Son of God. This is something totally different. I've never seen anything like this before. 3 hours of darkness, earthquakes, all kind of stuff going on. He said, that's not normal. That's not usual. Well, then, just briefly, the theologically significant events. And I don't want to spend a lot of time here, just kind of roughly review the triumphal entry. That's an acknowledgement of the Messiah, the King. This is the one that had been predicted throughout the Old Testament times that the Jews had been looking for. And he came. And the people as a whole, when Jesus came riding on the donkey, just as it had been predicted, they said, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. This is exactly who we're looking for. And then we have the Pharisees who said, hey, knock it off. Don't be treating this guy like that. Don't you realize that's blasphemy? You're acknowledging him as the chosen one of God. And he can't be that because we said he can't be. Because we're in charge here. And that seems to be kind of the way it is. That's the emphasis. But the presentation of a king is no small thing. But that's what they were acknowledging. And then we have the Passover. The recognition of the sacrificial lamb. And again, here Jesus says, with fervent desire I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. So he's anticipating. And then he's noting, I won't eat this again until it's fulfilled in the kingdom. And so he's looking forward to what's going to happen. And the time will come when he will be back with them and he will participate in this memorial event that will have even greater significance. But he's identifying himself ultimately with the sacrificial lambs of a previous historical event and indicating that he is not only the suffering servant, but he is the substitute. He is the real lamb that these other lambs have been prefiguring and anticipating. And it's also interesting, I think, that when Christ died on the cross, it was the exact time that the lambs would have been sacrificed in the temple. Great timing. So coincidental that it just happened that way. And then Gethsemane. Again, you can recall the text. And Jesus said, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. And he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. I thought this was what he was coming for. I mean, why wasn't he excited? Like, finally, you see here the humanity. the humanness. He was real. He was anticipating the horror of what was about to come upon him. And you can think, oh, yeah, the physical, you know, the mocking, the psychological abuse that he's going to be getting, that's a lot. The physical torture is incredible. But what was probably really the issue? The weight of the sin of the whole world resting on him? Can you just, I can't even imagine. I mean, just, I don't know if you really want to do this, but just think back over your life for just a second and think, you know, if I added up all of the sin or sins I have ever done and put them in a bag, how big would the bag have to be? And if everybody took their bag and put it, you know, heaped them up on Christ, what would he be carrying? I mean, that's, yeah, I would think there would be a bit of sorrowful even to death, very much. Well, then the trials. And again, we've seen some of these texts, and they were trying to come up with some testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. So they had to make some up. And it didn't agree. I mean, it was such a fabrication. And then they finally got him because they got him to say that he was the Christ. Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? You said, I am. Ah, we finally got him. He admitted. Well, if they'd have been paying attention, they would have realized this is who you've been waiting for. And they blew it. Just totally, totally missed it. How can that be? How can you miss that? Isn't it so obvious? He has fulfilled everything. But what were they worried about? Their personal power, their position, their prestige, their authority. They were focused on the wrong things. We ever get focused on the wrong things? Like every day? Everything else out there pulling at us so that we're not focused on what we ought to be focusing on. Well, then there's the crucifixion. And it's interesting that it just says it kind of briefly, and they crucified him. I mean, it gives you everything leading up to it, what comes after it, all the details, but they crucified him. Well, it was a known kind of form of execution, and it was deliberately made to be horrible. And you kind of don't really need to go into any more detail than that. But the question then is, when this happened, how should we view Jesus when he was crucified? Is he the victim? Is he the victim of people who had just gotten out of hand? They wanted their own things. Or was he the victor? He got the victory. And that's exactly what it is. He got the victory. I mean, there's a sense in which, yeah, he was a victim, but he gave his life for us. That's hugely significant. It was a victory for all. Even those who crucified him. It was a victory for them if they simply recognize and accept it. And then we have the temple veil torn from top to bottom. And the significance of that is probably quite obvious. Why from the top to the bottom? That was a pretty tall curtain. And if you or I were to go there, unless we have a really big and sturdy ladder that we can put up to start working at the thing, it's going to make a whole lot more sense for us to start tearing the thing from the bottom and just rip it on up. Why from the top to the bottom? Because God is initiating it and he's saying, okay, the glory of God and his presence has been veiled from everyone except for the high priest once a year in terms of being his presence associated with the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat. And now what Christ has done has opened the way. So we have open access. That's the picture. And that's what we want to focus on this morning as we celebrate the Lord's table together. And so just concluding thoughts as we prepare for that. The big drama is God defeating sin and Satan. And then the smaller drama is Israel rejecting her Messiah. And then the personal dramas. That's what happens in everybody's life. And everybody deals with conflict and emotion and struggle. And the question is, what are you dealing with today? And how will you respond to this unfolding drama? What conflict do you have going on that this can resolve? And we want to celebrate this resolution of the ultimate conflict in life that has been provided for.